morning, good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. There are two cases before the Texas Supreme Court, Cox versus Texas and Zurowski versus Texas, and they demonstrate the need for states with limits on abortion to either clarify or expand state statutes to protect children with fetal abnormalities from targeted termination. My guest is Rachel Roth Altizer. She writes from North Carolina, where she's a disability advocate and mom to four kids, one of whom is profoundly disabled. Her work on disability policy has appeared in numerous publications, including World Magazine, The American Conservative, and The Federalist. Rachel, thank you for joining me.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me, Al.
Let's talk about these two cases. What do you make of them?
Well, as you said, I am a mom and mostly a concerned constituent. So I'm just sitting at home sort of watching these cases unfold. I'm not a professional. I'm not an attorney. But sort of just like any other mom in America, I'm sort of watching the drama of this unfold and thinking how these cases might apply to my own life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think abortion advocates use emotions to make facts appear different than they are.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was reading about this case, I was struck to find, specifically in Cox versus Texas, and these cases are connected, but the facts that we were hearing from mainstream media are not the facts represented in the case.
Mm.
And I think that even just today, I was flipping through Slate Magazine, called Kate Cox's pregnancy, where she's pregnant with a child diagnosed with trisomy 18. Slate Magazine called that a non-pregnancy.
Wow.
So there's a lot of confusion in the mainstream media, purposeful confusion around the facts of these cases. And so as just a concerned parent, I started digging into this myself and actually read the court documents. And what I was shocked to discover was the entire premise of this case, Cox versus Texas, rested on the fact that Kate Cox's physicians alleged that her continuing a pregnancy with a disabled child was a threat on her life. Yet, her own testimony demonstrated that she was not concerned over her own life, but wanted to distance herself from the pain of bearing a disabled child. And that is the crux of this case.
So she's seeking an abortion to terminate
yes.
the life of a disabled child diagnosed with trisomy 18. Wow.
But if you'll look closely, the case is built around the fact that this should fall under a medical exemption for the life of the mother.
Yeah.
Yet her health was never at risk. And you'll see that in her own testimony. I have the quote here. I'll just read a bit of this.
Yeah, please do.
This is her own testimony, Ms. Cox. I do not want to put my body through the risks of continuing this pregnancy. I do not want to continue until my baby dies in my belly, or I have to deliver a stillborn baby, or one where life will be measured in hours or days, full of medical tubes and machinery. I do not want to watch my baby arrive in this world only to suffer.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
In her own testimony right here, she's not saying she's concerned for her life,
right?
And that is sort of the semantic game that these abortion advocates are playing, the Center for Reproductive Rights. So her representation, Molly Duane, also represents this other case before the Texas Supreme Court, Zurowski versus Texas. So these are connected. Now, what's complicated about the other case, Zurowski versus Texas, is that there's some question to if those plaintiffs have standing. None of them were currently pregnant. This is where Katie Cox became really helpful. At the appropriate moment in time, they needed a woman who could currently litigate her right to an abortion while pregnant.
Yeah.
In the state of Texas. And so they sort of looped this case in. Same representation, same doctors, same plaintiffs. These are connected. And so what I sort of, in looking through this, what I sort of argue is if if Katie Cox's life was really at risk, then she should have been rushed to the hospital as soon as they thought that her life could have been in danger,
yeah,
right?
Right.
And her doctor had, there's an exemption in the state of Texas for medical emergencies. They could use that, but there was no medical emergency.
Well, wouldn't the courts see through this?
So I think the Texas Supreme Court did. They ruled against Katie Cox. She traveled out of state to procure an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is what I am really concerned about and trying to sort of raise the alarm on the advocacy side for pro-life advocates is that we should anticipate that abortion advocates will try to equate fetal abnormalities with a maternal health risk.
Wow.
So basically saying that if you're carrying a disabled child, as Slate Magazine called it, that to them is considered a non-pregnancy.
Yeah. Complete negation of that, the life that's there.
Absolutely, because in their words, that's in the plaintiff's document in Cox versus Texas states that the state of Texas cannot demand that a pregnant person sacrifice, notice they say person, not woman,
mm-hmm.
sacrifice their life, fertility, or health for any reason, let alone in service of an unborn life, particularly where a pregnancy is not likely to result in the birth of a living child with sustained life. So those are two different things, right? Living child, and then they're qualifying sustained life. And that's just not true. The state of Texas doesn't require that a woman die. Right. There is medical exemption.
Right.
There is a possibility for a woman who's suffering an acute medical condition to procure an abortion to save her life. But that was not the case here. Katie Cox was not in danger. She was just carrying a disabled child.
Yeah. And someone who threatened her comfort, not her life.
Absolutely. And threatens. So the sort of typical risk. So one of the things that came up in this case was that she had had two previous C-sections. And the only risk that they cited was the threat of a third C-section. Well, that's typical risk, right? Because she would have assumed that risk had her child been born as a normal child with a C-section anyway. But suddenly, the typical risks of pregnancy became untenable because the object of that pregnancy was abnormal.
Now,
and so,
go ahead.
Well, I just think that sort of has really far-reaching implications for how we think about disabled people. If they don't fall within the scope of what we see as normal, then sort of the things that we're willing to take on, like parenting, suddenly become untenable, right?
Right.
So Katie Cox only wants to parent normal children that fall within her range of normal,
yeah.
which is incredibly dehumanizing to this whole other type of child who needs her mothering,
yeah,
right? That
yeah.
little baby that she's pregnant with, who tries to meet 18, unfortunately, who now, you know, now she's had an abortion, that child needs her as a mother, just like her other children do.
Yeah.
She is no less in need of parenting because she's disabled.
Yeah. Yeah. In this case, of course, the child is damaged goods. It's not what I bargained
right.
for.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And so our concept of parenting has really changed to where we're only willing to take on, like, quote, the risks, I guess, of pregnancy if the outcome is perfect, right? If it's sort of this perfect ending. But that's just not the reality of life.
Yeah. Now, let me you've written a piece for Public Discourse where you lead off by saying, "My son is blind, immobile, nonverbal, and hearing impaired with multiple brain abnormalities and complex orofacial birth defects." And then you ask the question, "Is he disabled?" Which then you go on to talk about the changing language surrounding disability.
Yeah, so I wrote this piece, and again, just to tie it back to the earlier case, I found out that my son would have a really complicated set of birth defects at 17 weeks gestation. So we weren't sure if my son David would survive to be born at all. Perhaps he would be stillborn, die in the womb. And then when he was born, we were told he would die immediately. After 16 days in the NICU, we discharged, and they told us to prepare for him to die overnight at home.
Mm-hmm.
But David is remarkable. He is very profoundly impaired. He does, like I said, or like you read, he is blind, he has a G-tube, he's hearing impaired, he's non-mobile, he's non-verbal. But that's not a statement on the value of David's life, right? That's a statement about logistics. Those are some logistic statements about how David interacts with the world. But that's not a statement on David's value or worth as a human being. So that's why this Kate Cox, this Katie Cox case is super compelling for me, because I saw a mother arguing the woman who vested, the only person who could be the true advocate for this little child, was arguing for its death, essentially. So then to pull it back, you know, when my son was born, we first applied for Medicaid. I live in the state of North Carolina, and there's a particular waiver, since we are over the income limit for Medicaid, that my son could qualify for to help with things like therapy, medical bills, food supplies, things like that.
Sure.
Well, we were actually denied Medicaid.
On what grounds?
Because they said that my son fit the state's definition of medical fragility, but because he had a two-parent household, that the experience of his disability was lessened. So basically, because I, as a mother, was doing my job and taking care of David, and he's part of a nuclear family, that the effects of his disability are therefore lessened. That's just discrimination.
That's weird.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and it's part of a semantic shift.
Yeah.
Saying that
they're not looking at they're trying to determine David's subjective state. You know, and yeah, this is going to create all kinds of policy headaches down the road, changing definitions of disability like this.
Yes, and what we're seeing is that disability is becoming a bit of an identity for some people,
yeah,
in the sense where it becomes a voluntary thing that people are saying, I'm identifying as a disabled person. Hmm. And yeah, it's good that there's more visibility to disability, but I think people with really profound disabilities like my son sort of risk falling by the wayside and losing access to essential services.
Rachel, thank you. I'd like to have you back where we can talk about this changing language about disability.
Yes. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you. Rachel Roth-Altizer.